Do you ever wonder where all your money went? Like every single time you look at your bank account? Honestly, it's probably all those subscriptions. I felt that way too, until I got Rocket Money. Rocket Money helped me see all the subscriptions I'm paying for, and it was eye-opening. Between streaming services, fitness apps, delivery services, it all adds up so quickly. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year, with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
From 30 Rockefeller Plaza in New York City, please enjoy this podcast edition of Late Night with Seth Meyers. On today's show, Seth talks to Los Angeles Mayor Eric Garcetti, who takes a few more questions backstage exclusively for this podcast. But first, a closer look.
As the Trump White House remains paralyzed by its own chaos, people across the country are taking to the streets to demand change, including thousands of striking teachers in West Virginia. For more on this, it's time for a closer look. Donald Trump seems to be the ever-present focus of our national political conversation, and to be fair, it's hard to take your eyes off him. It's like when someone starts yelling in a Starbucks. You're like, oh, this is gonna make a great anecdote as long as he doesn't kill us all. But the Trump era also seems to have sparked a larger political awakening across the country that goes beyond the daily drama of the Trump White House. We've seen that in the women's marches, the upcoming March for Our Lives against gun violence, and a march in Washington today to support Dreamers. And we're also seeing that kind of mass action in an unprecedented teacher strike in one of the most conservative states in the country, West Virginia.
West Virginia school teachers entering the eighth day of their strike. They want a 5% raise and better benefits. Nearly 277,000 students forced to stay home as a newly formed committee tries to settle the impasse.
Let me show you the scene here first. There are some 20,000 teachers who are on strike, and it feels like all of them are here at the state capitol.
You can tell they're teachers because that's the last new song they heard. I can't listen to the radio. I have to grade papers until 1 a.m. And I know they're striking for better pay and health insurance, but they could also save the school money for a prom band. We booked a musical act. Who is it? Mrs. Ferguson. She's coming in full Dee Snider makeup. If there's one takeaway from the last few weeks of politics, it's this. Don't with teachers. They make no money. They get up at 6 a.m. to drive their 15-year-old cars to a cruddy building, knee-deep in teenage hormones. You cannot scare them. The part of them that is capable of fear was burned away years ago by terrible teacher's lounge coffee. All they want is health care, a livable wage, and just once a class that doesn't laugh the first time they hear the word Uranus. Guys, it's not funny. It's a planet. And, Drew, stop telling Kevin to go to hell on your calculator. Oh, really, Drew? You got 7,734,206 by accident, Drew? Just do the equation again. Drew! Now, West Virginia teachers are striking in part because they make among the lowest salaries in the country, ranking 48th out of 50 states. Basically, all the teachers want are raises that cover cost of living increases and health care they can afford. And they made those demands very clear to West Virginia's governor, Jim Justice, who, despite his name, is not a gay porn star, but a coal magnate. You may know Justice as the governor who announced that he was switching from Democrat to Republican at a rally with Trump last year. Justice bragged to his friendship with Trump and also cited Trump's family as a reason for the switch.
What an incredible honor. And thank you for coming. And thank our great president for being here. This man is a reflection of his kids, children. Eric Trump has been under my vehicle in the back of the woods changing a tire.
What? What was Eric Trump doing in the woods? Is that where his dad dropped him off? Go on, boy, you're free now. Run. Don't follow the car. Now, last week, West Virginia officials thought they might have resolved the strike when Justice agreed to a 5% raise after initially opposing it. And at the time, he attributed his change of heart to a sixth grader.
As thousands of West Virginia teachers raised their voices, it was a 12-year-old's message that stood out to the governor.
Gideon Titus Glover, whose mom is a teacher, he asked why funds were being spent on tourism. The governor talked about return on investments.
If you put money in schools, you're making smart people. And if you have smart people, you can make more smart investments.
I agree.
Well, he's right. He's right.
Jim Justice is a real ball of fire. But after that announcement, the state Senate blocked the agreed-upon 5% raise, and on top of that, they still haven't addressed the issue of health care. In fact, just to give you an idea of how dire the health care situation is for teachers in West Virginia, not only did officials there announce that teachers would have to pay more for their health insurance, they also implemented a program called Ghost 365 that would track teachers' daily routines and increase their health care premiums if they failed to meet certain goals. Now, after backlash, the state made the program voluntary and less intrusive, but teachers are still justifiably angry about having to earn points just to be able to afford health care. Here's how one West Virginia teacher put it. You're telling me my deductible is going up, but I can do exercises to earn an Amazon gift card? Are you kidding me? F*** you. Damn. The last thing that teacher needs is a gun. He's already dropping bombs. There's a lot more going on here than just the teacher strike. What we're seeing in West Virginia is a microcosm of what's happening across the country. Working class people are being left behind by an economy increasingly dominated by the elite few, and they're pissed off, even in a seemingly deep red state like West Virginia. And it's not just teachers who are unhappy about everything from health care to the economy to the opioid crisis. As one teacher put it, there's a feeling that the whole state is ready for a strike. Wow. Imagine if entire states could go on strike. What do we want? Legalized weed. When do we want it? When do we want what? So clearly, this is not just a local issue. Working class people in one of the most conservative states in the nation are demanding a livable wage, better health care. That kind of thing is happening in communities across the country. We're seeing mass action to address everything from healthcare to gun violence. Meanwhile, in Washington, the president has neither the interest nor the ability to address those demands because of the chaos in his own administration. In fact, Trump is apparently so upset about the constant turmoil in his White House, he's lashing out by starting a fight over trade with our allies without even consulting his staff.
Spoiling for a fight, any fight, the president decided to pick one on trade, announcing new tariffs against the advice of many of his top advisors and without any internal review.
According to two officials, Trump's decision to launch a potential trade war was born out of anger at other simmering issues. On Wednesday evening, the president became, quote, unglued, in the words of one official familiar with the president's state of mind.
That's right. Much like his hair in a stiff breeze, Trump has become unglued. So Trump announced major new tariffs on steel and aluminum without consulting experts or lawyers in his own administration, all because he's upset at how his White House is melting down. And our allies immediately reacted harshly to the news. A Canadian aluminum official said Trump had initiated an all-out trade war. And the president of the European Commission said, this is basically a stupid process. The fact that we have to do this, but we have to do it. We will now impose tariffs on motorcycles, Harley Davidson, on blue jeans, Levi's, and on bourbon. Wow. They're going after blue jeans, motorcycles, and bourbon. Terrible news for European stepdads. Well, I guess it's back to Vespa and Ongina for Klaus. Now, there's no question that many American workers are hurt by the current system of global trade, and that system can absolutely be fixed. But Trump rolled out his ham-fisted strategy without consulting experts or allies or even getting his own team on board. In fact, the only Trump cabinet official who's been out there publicly supporting this move is his Commerce Secretary, Wilbur Ross, who went on CNBC last week and tried to downplay the effect of the tariffs for American consumers using props.
What I would like to do, though, is to emphasize again the limited impact. This is a can of Campbell's soup. There's in the can of Campbell's soup, there's about 2.6 pennies worth of steel. Here's a can of Coca-Cola. Coca-Cola has 3 cents worth of aluminum in it.
If you do choose to have that Campbell's soup, of course, remember there is a lot of sodium in there and a lot of sugar in the Coke as well. Just, you know, there you go.
Well, okay.
Very nice.
Now, I know you're thinking, he's a billionaire. What does he know about soup and beer? But Wilbur Ross seems like the kind of billionaire who only has soup and beer. Eats it at a giant, long Bruce Wayne table. In fact, I'm not sure Wilbur Ross, a billionaire financier, really knows that much about how these tariffs will affect working-class people, because in that same interview, he also dismissed the impact the tariffs would have on the price of a car.
It's a trivial effect. People talk about cars. There's about 1 ton of steel in a car, and the price of a ton of steel is $700 or so. So 25% on that would be 0.5% price increase on a typical $35,000 car. So it's no big deal.
No big deal, because 25% of $700 is $175, which is a big deal to a lot of people. Now, I could do that math for you on a calculator, but this is probably a little easier for you to understand. Also, every single time Trump's cabinet of millionaires talks about the price of a car, they manage to sound wildly out of touch. Trump economic advisor Gary Cohn did the same thing last year when he was trying to sell Trump's tax plan.
If we allow a family to keep another $1,000 of their income, what does that mean? They can renovate their kitchen. They can buy a new car.
$1,000 a year is not enough to buy a new car. In fact, $1,000 a year isn't even enough to buy food unless you're living on the Wilbur Ross diet. So you got thousands of teachers in one of the most conservative states in the country demanding fair pay and decent health care while the people in charge keep proving how wildly out of touch they are. What we're seeing is a national political awakening. In other words, people across the country are saying, this has been A Closer Look. Our guest is the mayor of Los Angeles. Please welcome to the show, Mayor Eric Garcetti. Welcome.
Thank you.
You know, my brother lives in L.A. I have so many friends in L.A. They always brag about the weather. And now you're in New York as the nor'easter is bearing down.
77 degrees and sunny in L.A. today.
Yeah, well.
I'll be back there tomorrow. So
you think you'll be back there tomorrow.
Yeah, that's what I was
I got a feeling
about.
You're going to be my next guest tomorrow.
You got a place to sleep?
Yeah, we got a place
awesome,
for you.
Awesome.
I'm always fascinated to talk to mayors because obviously we spend a lot of time on the show talking about national politics. And the people there spend a lot of time in their home districts, but obviously a lot of time in D.C. You spend all your time living where you serve.
Yeah.
You live amongst your constituents. Are people always coming up to you and telling them their problems?
Of course. It's the most direct democracy you can have. I mean, people find you at the grocery store. People find you at the park. I mean, they'll come up to you and tell you anything. You're like kind of a confessor and a priest. They'll say like, hey, Mayor, I had a great date last night. You're like, awesome. Or somebody come up, I had a terrible date last night. Well, let's talk about that. Why?
Yeah. And did you run on a dating platform?
I did. That could be taken two ways. I basically also have my parents as my constituents. So, you know, if you've had a Jewish mother ever before, like, it's like I'm at a community meeting. They're like, the traffic's really bad on the west side of L.A. I say, I know. My mom called me yesterday. She had trouble getting to my dad. And so it's a very accountable thing. But all joking aside, it's also where politics still lives. It's a place where you can listen to people, solve their problems, and actually accomplish something, which is so different than what we see in Washington. And that's not unique to L.A. That's every local community, I think, where we live. So, you know, don't give up on American politics just because of what you hear coming out of D.C.
And do you think, in general, there's more optimism and there's a better chance for optimism and change on a local level than there is on a national level?
Yeah, and you know, most politics happens locally anyway. I mean, it didn't matter whether it was going to be President Trump or President Clinton. Most of the work you're going to do on the environment is in your own backyard. Most of the work you're going to do on jobs and on education, on your commute and transportation. And people forget that because I think we cede a lot of power to Washington, D.C., But look at these kids in Florida. Like, that's their local community. There's more leadership coming out of our teenagers than coming out of Washington, D.C. And I also think it's practical leadership. People have strong beliefs in our cities, our local communities, but they also want to see the job get done. They won't settle just for a tweet, a retweet, a counter tweet. They want us to actually fix the street, like do something.
Yeah.
And the nice thing about being a mayor, if I don't fix it, I'm on that pothole.
So know? More streets, less tweets?
Absolutely.
Yeah, more streets,
more less, streets
less tweets.
More streets. I like it.
Well, of course, one of the problem in L.A., you mentioned potholes. Obviously, traffic's a huge deal. You guys have the Olympics coming in 2028. And I feel like this is the first time in a long time that I've heard someone actually got a good deal as a host city for the Olympics. And you have an initiative called 28 for 28.
Yes.
Is this about public transportation or just in general traffic?
Yeah, well, we're the unfortunately not only the car capital, but the traffic capital of America. But voters, the same night that President Trump was elected, there was other stuff on the ballot. And we passed a $120 billion initiative to build 15 transit lines in L.A., where cars reign supreme. And by 2028, when the Olympics come, we'll have 28 of those projects done that are improvements of roads, new lines, a lot of middle-class jobs, too, that you can't export. And I think people talk about politics, they say words like infrastructure. What does that mean? It means me getting home to my wife, my daughter. It means me deciding that I can make it to that date on time, take that job. We forgot to talk about things in human terms. So we're accelerating all this cool stuff for the Olympics. I'm really proud that America will get the Olympics back for the Summer Games, first time since 1996. And we're going to make money off of it because we have everything basically built in L.A. From the Rams Stadium that's going to be coming up, using UCLA as our Olympic Village. So we can focus on providing sports to a bunch of kids leading up to then and after.
That's really exciting. Yeah. You mentioned you're the capital of traffic.
Yes.
Another huge problem that L.A.'s had is homelessness.
Absolutely.
And this is a problem around the country, especially in big cities, but particularly bad in L.A. and getting worse.
Yeah.
What do you do? How do you address the problem of homelessness in big cities when housing is becoming more and more unaffordable?
And people always ask that. How can it be when we have such a strong economy, people are living in tents on the street in Washington, D.C., in Seattle, San Francisco, L.A., Fresno? It's red cities, it's blue cities, it's around the country. And I think we haven't built housing in this country. And we've seen federal government kind of no longer take any responsibility. It was under President Reagan in the early 80s that there was a homelessness program with Democrats and Republicans who said it's unacceptable for a kid who is a foster youth to be living on the street, for veterans to come home from war and be living on our streets. But the nice thing in L.A., voters passed not just one, but two initiatives to build 10,000 units of housing and also provide services for folks that are struggling with mental health, with addiction, with all of the trauma that they've, sexual violence that they've experienced and things like that. And that money's just starting to flow. So I'm confident by the time the Olympics come, we can end homelessness on the streets of L.A. But Washington can't take a pass on this. They have cut those dollars every year, Democrats and Republicans, for the last decade. And we need, help. This isn't just a local L.A. problem. It's national.
You mentioned your mother, a Jewish mother.
Yes.
Italian father.
He's Mexican-American with an Italian last name.
So yeah. So it was a bit of a soup. Obviously, your grandfather your father, which your grandfather was sort of a dreamer before the term existed.
Yeah, he was born in Mexico during the Mexican Revolution. My great-grandfather was hanged during the Revolution, and my great-grandmother picked up her son, 1 year old, and just did what mothers do and crossed the border and came over, eventually made it to L.A. And we didn't have that term back then. He wasn't a citizen. He didn't have papers. But when World War II broke out, he had two young kids, and he volunteered to fight for the only country he knew, just like dreamers today serve in our army and are teaching in our schools. And he got a citizenship as a result. And I'm here, mayor of the second biggest city in America, because this country said, that service matters, your patriotism matters. And yesterday was the deadline for dreamers. And I don't know if folks noticed it, but Washington didn't pass, as they said they would, a resolution for them, let alone for other immigrants we need to take care of. And in L.A., we embrace that. We embrace immigrants because they're our strength. They help protect our streets. They help our economy. And I think about my grandfather, and I think about those dreamers today who, I don't know how Washington functions, but I guess they don't have to live up to their word. Where I am, you do what you say you're going to do, and you actually live up to your word and get results.
I can't help but notice you kind of keep mentioning Washington and how Washington's maybe not that great. You've also maybe been thinking about running for president one of these days, maybe sooner than later. Some on the right would criticize you and say you are the definition of a Hollywood elitist because you are from Hollywood.
Mayor of Hollywood.
Yeah, the mayor of Hollywood.
That's
are
good.
You worried about how they might tie you to the entertainment industry, which I feel like has become such a bugaboo to the right?
I think, look, if we look at how well the White House is going, I might not run because they're doing such a good job.
Yeah, I agree
right
with
now.
You. What are you going like, to do?
I don't think
do
I could do that well.
How do you improve perfection? But, right, yeah.
No, in Hollywood, look, it's we're proud this is one of the American signature industries to the world. And, you know, I'm involved. I started a program there called the Entertainment Evolve Fund to make sure, long before Oscars So White and the Me Too movement, that we have kids who are growing up in communities of color, more women and girls, producing, directing, starring in, being the grips and the crew in Hollywood, because we're missing so many stories. And to me, that's been something long before that I've been passionate about. And I think it's not just there in Hollywood. It's throughout our industries that we have to make sure it reflects America. And this whole thing where we try to divide America, the coastal areas versus the heartland, East Coast, West Coast, rural versus urban, I think that's BS. There's Washington and the rest of us. And I know what it's like to see a factory close down. We do have more Kardashians than anywhere else, and
yeah,
we're very proud of that.
Yeah, yeah, of course.
But most of us are not Kardashians.
That's true. You have more non-Kardashians. You know,
we're mostly nurses and hospital workers and bus drivers and factory workers. The GM plant closed down in the San Fernando Valley where I grew up when I was a kid. So I can relate to that conversation at a local level with a mayor in Dayton, a mayor in Columbia, South Carolina, a mayor in South Bend, Indiana, like Mayor Pete, who you had on mm-hmm. here. And we speak the language, I think, of America. It's Washington that's that swamp, and it's only getting swampier.
Yeah.
And you can use that term if you ever want.
Thank swampier. You very much. Yeah. That's really, I like it. Hey, thank you so much for making the time
sure.
being here. I hope you
Perfect.
Get out.
Thank
if
you.
Not,
thank
welcome
you.
Back tomorrow. Mayor Eric Garcetti, everybody.
Hey, everybody, this is Henry from Late Night. I'm here with Mayor Eric Garcetti of Los Angeles. You were talking with Seth about 28 for 28, this massive transportation package
yeah.
Ahead of the 2028 Olympics in LA. I'm a huge transportation nerd. I'm really interested in it.
I've heard.
We'll see how interested our listeners are, but can you just kind of walk me through why you're so interested in it as a mayor and why you've kind of focused on it as an issue?
Look, transportation is everything. Like, we talk about it in technical terms, people tune out. But think about it. It gets you to work. It gets you to church or to your house of worship. It's how you get to friends. It's the decisions that you make in a given day of how much time you're going to spend on your commute is everything. And in LA, we're the traffic capital of America,
right.
unfortunately. A longer commute than anywhere else. We had really cutting edge technology back when we had a red car system in the 20s and 30s and 40s. Then we had cutting edge technology called freeways until suddenly there was too many people and not enough room. And so 2 years ago, we passed the largest infrastructure, transportation infrastructure package in American history times two. Mm-hmm. Just to give you an idea, it's $120 billion to do 15 lines in LA, fix our freeways, pave our streets. And I think it's really exciting because it's not just old school transportation. We also think a lot of new technology is going to come online in those 40 years as we build this out. But we said the Olympics is a great deadline. Everybody loves a deadline. Let's get as much done. And we passed this package called 28 by 28 mm-hmm. so that 28 improvements will be done by the time the Olympics come.
One of the improvements, it's not part of this package,
yeah.
but you've been meeting with Elon Musk.
Yes.
And he's got something called the Boring Company.
Uh-huh.
So can you explain what that project is and what those conversations are like?
Well, it was funny. Elon tweeted out one weekend, I think, hey, I'm going to change the way we're tunneling in the world. And then he called me the next day and he said, do I need any permits for this? And I said, yeah, why don't I come visit you? And to his credit, he bought one of these huge earth-eating machines. If you've never seen one, go like Google it. But these amazing, amazing machines that literally chew up the earth, are like a drill, and then spit out the muck, they call it, the dirt in the back. And he said, I'm going to make this as much as 14 times faster. Because if we could create a series of tunnels under Los Angeles, we could get people to and from where they need to go much better, much quicker. And a year later, they've already done a mile. They're going to have their second drill go into the ground in our city. Wow. And what I tried to do is say, let me be a guide. Instead of giving you 50 reasons to say no, which is what most governments and politicians do, I'm going to get you to yes, and let's do this together and figure it out.
Right. You've talked about, and this gets to this point of like focusing on the future and mm-hmm. thinking about the future. How do you say yes to big, untested ideas while also knowing that presents a risk? Financial, safety, logistical. How do you kind of think about what you can agree to that hasn't been done before? Like the Boring Company, like something like that.
Well, I think often leaders are either future phobic, like, oh no, like people are buying books online, we have to stop that. Right. Or people are using an app to get a car to take them someplace. And that's not a very successful strategy. Yeah. But the other is that most people then, if they're not future phobic, they get kind of future passive. Like it's coming uh-huh. and there's nothing I can do to help guide it. where I get excited is being future guiding and saying, mm-hmm. let me sit down with an Elon Musk and I'll tell you what some of the challenges are from the landscape politically or even in the actual land of LA to do an idea like that. And you tell me what the challenges are engineering wise and let's solve it together mm-hmm. and get to yes. I mean, I think right now you're going to see vertical takeoff and landing cars. We told Uber that with Dallas would be one of the first two cities to test it. Mm-hmm. Most cities would say, let another city figure it out first. Right. I'd rather be there and help actually drive how that occurs.
Right. Well, this gets to something else you've talked a lot about is the importance of data uh-huh. on cities.
Yep.
It seems like all cities should easily accept data. Was that kind of a fight when you became mayor of LA to use more data in decision making?
Well, it was two things. One, we were unranked in terms of opening up our data to the public when I became mayor. We've been 3 out of the last 4 years number one in the country now because I told every head of every department, from the police department, fire department, to our airport, port, you have to share this. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it's going to show us some things that are embarrassing. Like the LA Times did an article that said that it was taking 3 times as long to pick up a couch that was left for pickup in certain parts of town than another one. But guess what? Everybody, when they said, see, I told you it was going to embarrass you, said, I don't care, fix it. And within 2 weeks, it was equal everywhere in the city.
Right.
So there was some initial resistance, but I think everybody's bought off on it. And we just won an award from Bloomberg Philanthropies and a bunch of groups that ranked basically every big city in America as the top city for using data in America. The only one that got what's called the gold standard, 8 right. got the silver, and then others finished below that. But it informs everything. The dashboard I look at on my phone, which has all the stats of what we're doing right and wrong, is available for the public. So when it's red, which means we're not hitting our goal, the public knows it too and can hold me accountable, which is not usually the way politicians approach things, but I love right. it because then I can get on whoever we need to fix that in the city.
Right. How much do you talk about Mayor Pete Buttigieg from South Bend, Indiana. You have, is it the Conference of Mayors?
Yeah, U.S. Conference of Mayors.
How often do you guys steal ideas from each other?
We're thick of thieves all the time. I love mayors. And it's not just the U.S. Conference of Mayors. Mayor Hidalgo, who was competing against us for the Olympics mm-hmm. from Paris, she and I are great friends now. And we share ideas. Sadiq Khan, the mayor of London, Mayor Mancera, or Jefe de Gobierno, which means chief of government in Mexico City. Like, we share everything from, you know, ideas on bicycle lanes and busways to mass yoga in the middle of, you know, Mexico City as a way of getting people healthy. And throughout the United States, there's this amazing network of mayors, Republicans, Democrats, independents, and we don't really care about party affiliation first. Mm-hmm. We care about what's working and we want to steal it for our cities.
Yeah, I can imagine that it really is true that you don't care about party affiliation because senators come on and they're like, oh, we see across party lines. And then they work within their caucus. Look, completely.
I'm out and proud Democrat and sure. really consider myself progressive, but I also could do things like raise the minimum wage in my city mm-hmm. and also reduce the city's business tax. Like right. Democrats, like, we don't reduce taxes, we raise minimum wage. Or if you're Republicans, you can lower the business tax, but you're not supposed to raise the minimum wage when most Americans want both.
Yeah.
And so I think mayors really transcend this moment where everybody's like, oh, tell me if you're an R, tell me if you're a D, I'll tell you if I love you or I hate you, end of story.
Right. We were chatting earlier about this moment for mayors mm-hmm. Under President Trump, and you said it's actually inspired a lot of interesting change. It's kind of motivated you guys, all of you, to do a little bit more.
Yeah, I mean, I'll give you an example. It was unfortunate that our president was one of the only people in the world to withdraw from the Paris Climate Accords. Uh-huh. I think it's the wrong side of history and destructive. But when he did that, instead of crying about it or yelling at him, I picked up the phone. I chair Climate Mayors, a group around the country, a bipartisan group of mayors who are concerned about climate change. And we said, if he's out, we're in. And we got mm-hmm. pledges of these cities to enact the Paris Climate Accord. So we're up to 398 cities in 47 states. And as I joke with some friends, I bet if it was President Clinton and we were still in it, those cities would be less motivated. So sometimes sure. somebody hands you an opportunity, and most of the action on climate change is going to happen in cities that control transportation networks, mm-hmm. building codes, electricity generation. So I'd love to have a Washington partner. I miss that.
Yeah.
But we're not powerless. In fact, most of the power is in city hands. So just act instead of ceding that to this White House.
Right. Last thing I wanted to ask you, this gets back to this Trump moment. You're talking about your grandfather being a dreamer. Yeah. What has the effect in LA been of Trump's anti-immigrant rhetoric, his crackdown on undocumented immigrants? What has the effect been, and how do you combat that at your local level?
It's made us less safe. You know, I think that it's been very impractical, as well as being, you know, the moral issues around it. I'll never stop listening to police officers mm-hmm. over politicians about what works. And I care more about the safety of my people and my city than the president does. And we've had police chiefs for almost 4 decades who have said, the way you get trust from everybody is to protect everybody and make sure that they know you're not part of an immigration deportation force. In fact, in December, we had a police officer who was shot. She was an immigrant herself from Korea. A guy just randomly shot at two police officers and hit her in the leg. We were able to get that attempted murderer within a half hour because in this very immigrant-rich community called Westlake, people trusted the cops. And they said he went that away. We found him in a store and he was charged with murder. We protect them because they protect us. And I feel like what's coming out of Washington is making us less safe, not more.
Yeah, that seems to be bearing fruit across the country, yeah. Internationally.
Yeah.
But it's really interesting to hear about what you're doing in LA,
yeah.
Because people feel the results and you are held accountable in the way that people in DC are not. The same way.
I think, you know, I still do think that maybe I'm an idealist, that politics is about doing what you say you're going to do,
right.
Keeping your word, and actually producing results. DC is like about producing retweets. It's about like getting people pissed off and breaking your word.
Yeah.
And no wonder people are pissed at politicians. No wonder, you know, we had a president who was going to drain the swamp and it's, you know, wetter than ever.
Yeah.
It's really discouraging. But I tell people, you get 5 minutes a day to yell at your TV, mm-hmm. and to argue on your Facebook feed. Now get back to work and volunteer in your community, vote in the midterm elections. Like, there's so much power that you have, and it's only as bad as you make it. If you give them that, then fine, that's where it's going to stay. But I think in local communities, people know it's different.
Yeah. Let's end on that. It's awesome. An inspiring message, and there's a lot to look forward to in LA coming up. Great. Thank you so much for being here. It's such
Thanks
a pleasure.
Thanks so much, Henry. Appreciate it.
Want more Late Night with Seth Meyers? Be sure to follow the handle @LateNightSeth on Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, Instagram, and Snapchat. You can also watch full episodes of Late Night at LateNightSeth.com or on the NBC app. And please tell your friends who are fans of Seth Meyers to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes.
This episode is brought to you by the effortlessly scrumptious bite of Skinny Pop Popcorn. Imagine this: perfectly popped, endlessly delicious kernels, a symphony of just three simple ingredients: popcorn, sunflower oil, and a sprinkle of salt. No compromise, just pure snacking freedom. And hey, if you're up for a twist, dive into flavors like zesty white cheddar to sweet and salty kettle. Every bite's a delight, light and oh so tasty. Shop Skinny Pop now.